Howdy, folks, and welcome back to our podcast on statistics for the social sciences. Jenny here, glad to be rejoining you for continuation of our week 10 conversation around significance. And today we are going to continue that dialogue, moving into more on hypothesis testing. First, the types of errors we can encounter with hypothesis testing and the ways that we can avoid them. And then much more in detail on the actual steps to test our hypotheses. The way this is presented in your textbook is as an 8-step process, but I like simplifying to about 5 steps. So either way you look at it, it's going to be a number of steps that we complete to test that null hypothesis. Remember, the null is always the one that we are going to be testing when we look at our research question. And the reason for that is we're going to basically be able to say if our statistical significance is there or our test statistics are extreme enough, then we can reject the null hypothesis that there's actually, you know, something going on here is what we're going to be saying. We can make a more clear assertion or argument that probably our independent variable is what's affecting our dependent variable. But let's step back just a hot minute from that and make sure that you have made your way to the week 10 slides. If you haven't yet, go ahead and crack those open. And we're going to be at slide 20, where we talk about the types of errors in hypothesis testing. So again, statistical significance is all about the risk we're willing to take that we reject the null hypothesis when we shouldn't. Or in more common language, that we observe something in a study that isn't actually what's going on in the real world. I want to make clear as part of this conversation, when we run into possible errors with hypothesis testing, when we might, you know, say that something's going on that isn't actually, that may not be our fault. It might be that our sample is really unique or demonstrates something different from the population. It just might be a fluke, so to speak. It might be that we did something actually that is our fault. Maybe we didn't do sampling very well. Maybe we don't have a representative sample, or we didn't maybe do random sampling in the process of trying to get our population or get a subset of our population, that is. There's possibilities both ways. But I want to make clear, there's a real chance you could have an error with your hypothesis testing, even when you did everything right. And that's because we're working with a sample. It's not the whole population, so we can't be sure. So there's 2 general types of errors we can encounter with hypothesis testing. And they're just the flip side of the same coin, okay? 2 sides of the same coin. Type 1 error. You say there's a difference or something is going on here. There's a relationship, but there isn't, okay? So I'm saying that my independent variable likely has an effect when in reality it does not. This is exactly the kind of risk we run with statistical significance. We're going to reject the null. We're going to say there has to be something going on here, but in truth, there isn't. And that's type 1. Type 2 as an error is you say there is no difference, but there is. And here, basically what we're doing is we're accepting the null hypothesis when we should be rejecting it. So type 1, you reject the null hypothesis when you should accept it. And type 2, you accept the null hypothesis when you reject it. Okay. Clarifying and tying this back to significance on slide 22. If my level of significance is that p less than 0.01, which translates to the probability is less than 1% that this is due to chance, that is exactly the chance I have of making a type 1 error, because we're making it that level of significance or making sure our test statistic is that extreme that we don't mess it up very often. So thinking back to that normal curve, that P of 0.01, if that's a Z-score, my Z-score has to be like greater than 2.56 or less than negative 2.56. It's very, very rare. That's leaving just 1% in the tails of that normal distribution. That P of less than 0.01, again, means that that Z-score has to be more extreme than one of those two values. And because we're saying it's more extreme, it's kind of like high jump. High jump has different levels you have to clear. Let's say it's 6 foot. For most high jumpers, that might be not too bad. 8 foot's a higher bar. It's harder to clear that bar or harder to get more extreme than that. 10 foot, even worse. As in, harder to clear the bar. Our statistical significance is those bars. And if we have a p-value of 0.1 or the 10%, that's not so far out as 5%, p of 0.05, which is also not so far out as p of 0.01. In short, we're making it harder and harder for our test statistic to be as extreme as it needs to be for us to do something with the null hypothesis that isn't supported by what's going on in reality. There's a lot here. I know this is a lot to kind of work through right off the bat, but kind of keep that in mind, remembering that type one, this is you rejecting the null when you shouldn't, and if you set your significance level pretty high, as in you only want to reject the null hypothesis when it's not true in maybe 1% of the cases, that means 99 out of 100 times you're going to have the right answer to your question, but 1 out of 100, you're not. If you have it at the 5% level, 1 out of 20 times you're going to have the wrong answer to the question, but 19 out of 20 you will. This is, again, if we are going to make an error, we can make it harder to make a type 1 error by at least saying, well, let's increase my significance so that I go from it being a 5% chance to a 1% chance. That sounded kind of backwards, right? Increasing the significance. Maybe we think about it instead of just making the bar higher. Instead of a 5% chance of error, we're going to raise that bar to just 1%. All right, knowing that we can't be sure of our results, because there's always a possibility of us being wrong, and that can lead to error, I've done a little 2x2 table on slides 24 and 25 to clarify what kind of error space we're in. So in this first slide, 24, if I accept the null hypothesis and say there is no relationship, and there really is no relationship, I'm fine. That's good. I've come to the right conclusion with my hypothesis about the data that I have. But if I accept the null and say there's no relationship or there's no difference between groups, but there actually is, that's my type 2 error, also known as a false negative. If I instead reject the null hypothesis and say there's something else going on here, there's a relationship or a difference between my groups, and there is no relationship between my variables or no difference between my groups, that's my type 1 error, or a false positive. If I reject the null and say there is a relationship and there actually is, then again, I'm good. So thinking about this with COVID testing, like on slide 25, if my COVID test says I don't have COVID and I really don't, great, I'm in a good space. I can go out and hang out and not worry about being a transmitter of COVID. But let's say my test says I don't have COVID and I do. I could easily go out and spread the virus. That's that false negative. I don't want that to be the case. Likewise, I don't want to be stuck inside with a COVID test that says I have COVID when I don't. That's a false positive where now I'm on lockdown and I can't leave my house. And that's not a great feeling. Now, if COVID is there, like I have it, and the test says I do, at least I have the right test result. I may not be in a great place, but at least I know the truth of the matter and I actually understand what's truly going on. Okay, at this point, I want you to step back and I want you to try and identify what potential type 1 and type 2 errors you can see with your research question. And I want you to think about framing these in a very specific way. Essentially, your independent variable and your dependent variable, in a null hypothesis, you're saying they have no relationship. So rewrite your null hypothesis. And then think about how you would be either accepting or rejecting that null hypothesis versus what's going on in reality. Write out your type one as you rejecting the null and saying there is a relationship when in reality that's not the case. And then write out type two as you accepting the null again when in reality that is not the truth. And go ahead and send that to me. Shoot me an email with those type one and type two errors for your specific research question. And then I can verify those for you and make sure they look pretty good or solid, at least on this concept. Okay, moving right along. We know we can make errors, but we don't want to. That's really not the ideal, you know, in terms of answering our research question. We want a real legitimate answer. So how do I limit my errors? Well, if I want to get fewer false positives, I do that increasing the bar, raising the bar. That high jumper can't just clear 8 feet. It now has to clear 10 feet, which here I go with using a lower statistical significance number, like 1% instead of 5% or 0.01 instead of 0.05. It's harder to reject the null hypothesis because I've set my numbers to be more extreme. I need a z-score of not 1.96, but 2.56. That's more extreme. That's a harder value for you to achieve with a sample in terms of, is your sample really going to be that different from the average? Well, if you're certain that your variables are making a difference and we think that there is a relationship, then you should be able to have something that extreme. This is the simple way that we reduce false positives. We make it harder to get that false positive. Now, false negatives, the type 2 errors, this is a bit more difficult because really we should be seeing something going on here. We should be seeing a relationship between our variables or a difference between the groups that we're comparing, and we don't. And the only real way to address that, to fix that, is to add more to our sample. Adding more to my sample will hopefully make it more representative of the population and give me a much better chance of seeing what I'd expect to see in terms of my independent and dependent variables. This isn't always true though, okay? So I need to be clear. Sometimes adding more to our sample will continue to give us the same false negatives. And then we need to be thinking about, well, why might my sample be giving me a weird result that we don't expect? And there's some good theories about that, or, well, really theories are just explanations. We need to be thinking about what are our explanations as to why the sample might not be showing us what we expect to see. We, of course, could be wrong. There might not be a relationship, but often we have a pretty good reason for believing that. So separate from that, maybe there's something unique about our sample. Maybe there's something else that's affecting the way we're doing our analysis. Maybe there's even something like confounding variables getting in the way here. So if you have a type 2 error or a false negative, increase the number in your sample. And then if you continue to see no relationship, but you think that there really is one, consider what it is about the sample that might be giving you this odd result. Okay. Hopefully we have a bit of a sense, hopefully a strong sense, in fact, of what statistical significance means or is. And we now have some familiarity with the errors that we can see when we test our hypotheses, specifically that null hypothesis. But we need to pull this all together because we need to set out some steps for how to do that hypothesis testing that connect our research question to an actual answer for that question. So slide 30, we are trying to take ourselves from working with a sample and having some descriptive statistics to knowing about our population with inferential statistics. And that is what hypothesis testing is doing. It's taking the information about our sample and using that information to understand what's going on with our population. So statistical testing is inferential statistics. It's not the descriptive statistics. We're not just summarizing about our sample or our population. We're taking the knowledge we get from our sample and applying it and testing it in a way to see if what we see here is likely going to tell us what we think is going on with our population. Okay, I've written out all of the steps starting on slide 31. And as I said before, I list this as 5 steps because I think the step presentation in the textbook is a little confusing. Like step 5 for them is 2 different steps. It doesn't honestly matter how you choose to look at it, whether it's the 5 steps or the 8 steps in the book. At its core, these are the things you're going to be doing. Number 1, write out your null hypothesis. And when I say write it out, I really do mean that. I want you to write the null hypothesis so that we become familiar with how that looks and how to create them. Step 2, set your significance level. How risky are you willing to be with getting the wrong answer? Let's say, if you're uncomfortable with possibly getting the wrong answer, or you don't have that many people in your sample, you might be willing to take a little bit more risk. You may not have a ton of information here. So you might set your significance level at 10% with a very small sample. For most research in the statistical sciences, we're going to go with a 5% level, as in I got a 1 in 20 chance that I reject my null hypothesis when I should not. Now you can also step that game up a little bit. Let's say you have a lot of information, you have a very large sample, then you should probably go with a 1% significance level because you have enough information to really test your hypothesis effectively. After we've done that, we move on to step 3, where we choose the right test and we calculate what is known as the test statistic. Choosing the right test is knowing what we're looking at. Are we comparing a population and a sample if we're trying to find out, is this subportion of the population different than the rest of the group? Or maybe we're comparing 2 sample groups. Did my group in 1 English class do better than a different English class based on some sort of coaching we did with the class? Is the coaching, you know, as the independent variable affecting their test scores? Or maybe I use the same group at 2 different times. And I do something in between the 2 testing times to try and help them do better. That's going to give us something like a t-test where we have 2 groups. Maybe I'm comparing more than 2 groups, and that's going to be an ANOVA is the right test there. Or maybe I am actually looking at a whole bunch of different variables. Maybe I'm thinking about 4 different things that might be affecting someone's mental health, and I want to know which of those things really is important in affecting that mental health outcome. In that case, I'm probably doing a regression, but we're gonna figure out the test by identifying what are we doing. Are we comparing groups of people to try and figure out a difference between them that ties back to our independent variable, or are we looking at a bunch of variables to try and figure out how those affect one dependent variable? Calculating this test statistic is very simple. We just use SPSS to run the test. We're going to go back to using SPSS regularly now, and we're going to do it in pretty much the same way where we analyze something, but we're, instead of analyzing just descriptive statistics, we're going to move into analyzing inferential statistics with elements, again, like one of those tests. Maybe we're doing a 1-sample test. Maybe we're doing a t-test. Maybe we're doing an ANOVA. And all we have to figure out is, okay, what kind of comparisons am I doing or what am I looking at? Is it groups or is it variables? And then how is that set up? Eventually, we'll figure out which test to do and then we run that test in SPSS. That moves us into step 4, where now we have to look at our test statistic and compare it to what's known as a critical value. That critical value is the actual, let's say, z-score associated with our p-value or probability. So if the probability that we have set for ourselves, the significance level, is 0.05, then my z-score has to be more extreme than a 1.96 or a negative 1.96. It needs to be either higher than the positive 1.96 or lower than the negative 1.96. That value, that 1.96, is my critical value. And again, it's tied to the level of significance. This is generally where we get tripped up, by the way, in the testing process. It's hard to think about the test statistic versus the critical value. Your test statistic is always going to be calculated for you by SPSS, and you'll see it in the SPSS results. In fact, if you have a chance, I would go ahead and say step away from the slides for just a minute And look at the Week 10 Roadmap page where there's a number of additional handouts that I've created to help us work through this part of the conversation. The first being statistical significance, p-values, and SPSS. And it's just titled Significance and P-Values. But what this handout is trying to do is to explain statistical significance again, identify what a p-value is, that probability, right? The probability of something being due to chance rather than something else going on here. And then looking at how this looks in SPSS. So if you scroll down to the second page there, what I've got is a number of different results from SPSS, as in copied from the program and pasted into this handout. And what I've outlined in the orange is the actual significance values, which is really what we're going to use to compare. But if you look usually to the left, what you can see on that handout are the actual test statistics. For the one sample test, it's that value underneath the T, the negative 1.681. For the independent samples t-test, it's the F value, the 4.463. Those are my test statistics. For the dependent samples t-test, it's unfortunately not quite easy to find. It's not on the left. It's actually the T value of about 3.893 there. For the ANOVA, it's the F of 28.773. And then for the linear regression, I'm actually going to be looking at my coefficients. Those are going to be my quote-unquote test statistics. If you are a little tripped up on this as a general idea and concept, don't worry. We're going to continue talking about it further. But I could also, or would also, encourage you to take a look at the other two handouts. We have the critical values handout and then the other examining critical values using images or explaining critical values using images. So critical values, again, these are going to be the test statistic numbers that match up with that probability that we want, our significance level. There's going to be a lot, again, practice with this, especially with respect to page 2 of the critical values handout. So don't get too freaked out by this. We'll continue the conversation. But if you're a visual person in particular, I would say go ahead and take some time to look at explaining critical values using images, because I think this may be a little bit better for visual learners. That being said, don't worry too much about fully understanding these. We will come back to this. This conversation is really what we're going to continue doing for the remainder of the semester. Now, if I am trying to get to that last little bit where I answer my research question, which is step 5, I have to do that comparison between my test statistic and my critical value. And if my test statistic exceeds the critical value, it's more extreme. As in, if it's compared to a negative number, it's below that negative number. If it's compared to a positive number, it's greater than that positive number. I am at the point where I can answer my research question on rejecting my null hypothesis, right? I'm going to take that null hypothesis. I'm going to reject it when it's more, that test statistic is more extreme. And I'm going to say, awesome. I can say there's an effect here. I'm never going to be totally sure that my independent variable is the thing affecting my dependent variable because we don't have an experimental setup here. We've not isolated all the other things that could be going on, or generally we're not. If you're in the social sciences and able to do a full experiment, you may be truly able to say there is causation in a certain situation. But for most of us, we're not going to be able to do full experiments. We're going to be dealing with real people and real life situations. So we're probably just going to be saying, look, something's going on here and I think it's this and I think this study has made a strong case for that, right? I think I've found good support for what I think is going on. Now, if I were to translate these steps into how it would look using SPSS, most of it will remain the same, but there's going to be a slight difference at the end. And this is all captured on slide 32. So my first three steps are still the same. I write my null, I set my significance level, and I calculate my test after figuring out which one I need to run. But then to make it simpler, I compare the p-value from my results in SPSS to what my significance level is. And it will truly be listed as a p-value, or sometimes it'll be abbreviated SIG, S-I-G, in the SPSS results. Go back to that significance handout. Look at what is outlined in the orange, those orange boxes. That is where I'm showing you where the significance appears in those SPSS results. And those numbers are what we're going to compare to either our 0.01 or 0.05 that we chose from step two. If my p-value in SPSS is below that number from step two, as in it's 0.04 and I had set my significance level at 0.05, here is again where I reject the null hypothesis, because what I found is less likely. It's only got a 4% chance, not a 5% chance. It's less likely. And that's going to lead me again to reject that null. I'm not going to say there's no relationship or my independent variable makes no difference. I'm going to say something's going on here. My result is extreme enough to say something's happening. Something. It's not just due to chance. Okay, tons to process with this entire conversation, and I want to reassure you we're going to come back and review this again and again for the next 4 weeks. But if I want to walk you through with just an example before we close out our conversation today, let's do this. Let's talk about the example I keep coming back to, the programming and returning to prison. So step one, my null hypothesis. I can write it one of two different ways. I can do a directional or a non-directional null hypothesis. If I say something directional, like programming decreases my rates of recidivism, then my null hypothesis is also going to be directional, okay? Where I would say maybe individuals with more than 20 hours of programming don't have a lower recidivism rate, or programming does not decrease. That's directional because, again, I'm saying one variable changes the other variable in a certain way. If I wanted to write it as a non-directional null hypothesis, I just take away that decrease and I simply say there's no effect, right? In general, I expect that there is an effect, but my non-directional null hypothesis here would be programming does not have an effect on whether someone comes back to prison. I hope reading through these examples makes sense, but if not, at any point in time, please shoot me an email and check in so that I can do more clarification. But that is it for step one. We've got my null hypothesis. So step two, I'm going to set my significance level, and I'm going to say I'm going to use the normal kind of standard for most social sciences, which is the 5% significance level. I'm willing to be wrong one time out of 20, right? That's a real possibility, but it's a pretty limited one because I'm saying it has to be pretty extreme. So that's step two. Now, connected with step two, I have to be thinking actually about my null hypothesis here and whether it is directional or non-directional, because I could either have that 5% split between the two tails when I have a non-directional hypothesis. In that case, I'm saying I don't know if the effect is going to be greater than or less than in terms of recidivism. I just think that there could be an effect. In that way, I have to say, well, it could be, again, a positive effect or a negative effect. And I will take that significance and I will split it into the two tails of my normal distribution, like what you see on slide 35. But if I have a directional hypothesis and I say, well, it's only going to decrease recidivism, then all of my significance is in one side because I'm saying there's a particular way this relationship is going to work. So in that case, I'm going to say, well, it all goes in one end, more like what's pictured on the right side of slide 35. This is going to affect what the critical values are that I need to get. If it's a two-tailed test, you can see that the areas line up with different, let's say, z-scores at the bottom of the normal distributions. On that slide, with the left one, the left picture, the two-tailed, that z-score is like 1.96 or negative 1.96 because I've split my significance into the tails. So if I have 5% significance, there's 2.5% in one end of the distribution and 2.5% in the other end of the distribution. But if it's one-tailed and directional, all 5% goes into one area. So you can see the Z-score on the one-tailed test on the right is the 1.64 or 1.65, not 1.96. Again, these would be my critical values. So I'd have to get in the two-tailed test, where I have a non-directional hypothesis, a Z-score below negative 1.96 or above 1.96 to really be sure that I have something going on here and that I can reject my null hypothesis. But with the directional, the one-tailed test, my Z-score only has to be and can only be greater than 1.645 to really reject that. This is, again, a little bit complicated in terms of thinking about it, but I want you to review slides 35 and 36 and see the connection between what we're doing with significance and how we're either splitting it up in a two-tailed test for a non-directional hypothesis, or we're putting it all in one portion of the normal distribution. Either it's got to be a lower than number, in which case it's on the left-hand side of that normal distribution, kind of like what you see with the middle picture of a normal distribution on slide 36, or it's got to be greater than, which means it should look like the normal distribution on the right-hand side of slide 36. Okay, again, a lot to process. I know there is a lot with this conversation. I do say this is the heart of the course for a reason. And that being the case, it's also pretty in-depth at times. Okay, so we're going to have, let's say we use my non-directional null hypothesis, and we say that programming does not have an effect. So I split my significance into the two tails, and I went with my 5%, so there's 2.5% in each tail. That's going to give me my cutoff point for a standard Z-score, or for really any of the tests that we're doing in the future. But that leads me into step three. What test do I need to do, and how do I calculate that test? And there's a tool here in your textbook which helps a great deal with this, which is a decision tree. The decision tree is illustrated on page 178. It's figure 9.1 if you have the 7th edition of the textbook. If you have the electronic book, it's a little bit harder to find. In the system that I have, which is VitalSource, it shows up on 177 out of 486. But I'm not sure that that's what all of you have, because I think CoreText or Context is what a lot of individuals are using now. So really what you should look for is figure 9.1. Wherever you can find that, that will be helpful for you. And this is truly, like I said, a decision tree where we start with some questions and we work our way down. So our first question, are you examining relationships between variables or examining the difference between groups of one or more variables? And this is a little bit harder than it seems, because let's say I'm interested in looking at the relationship between mental health and suicide rates. Am I looking at variables, or am I possibly comparing groups as far as that mental health goes? You can do it either way, to be honest with you. So let's say the answer to my question is I'm examining differences between groups on one or more variables. Using the decision tree, then, I would go to the right and I answer, or I ask, a new question. Are the same participants being tested more than once? So is it the same group at two different times? My answer would be no here. So how many groups am I dealing with? Let's say I only have two groups. That leads me through the decision tree to a t-test for independent samples. And that's exactly how we would use this diagram. The decision tree gives you the questions to walk through, and the answers then point you to which test you need to eventually use in SPSS. So it's a lot harder than sometimes this flow chart might make it seem. And I'm here to support you through all of this. So we're going to practice all of these different types of tests. And I want to assure you, for the final paper, I'm going to give you very specific instructions based on your data set of what tests you need to complete. So if you get a little lost in this, don't worry too much, but I want you to come back to it and at least practice using this decision tree to know how it works. It's not too hard. And generally with some practice, we get better at it. It's kind of like a choose your own adventure, except we're just answering questions about our research process to get us further into deciding what test we need to do. Okay, That's step three. And we are now on step four. So if I had my plan that I did for my study design, I compared two groups of individuals in prison. So I would have been doing an independent samples t-test. And for step three, I would have finished running that t-test through SPSS. And then I'd get to step four, where I need to look at what I got out of SPSS and compare it with the critical value, or more likely, the level of significance I had from step two, looking at the p-value from my results. So if I have my 5% significance level and I look at my t-test results, and those t-test results, by the way, are going to look something like the second picture of SPSS results on that significance and p-values handout, under where it says for an independent samples t-test, that's what my results are going to look like. And I got to look at those numbers. If I had the numbers that appear on the significance and p-values page of a 0.126 or a 0.253, I'm going to be bummed out, because 0.126 is not smaller than or less than 0.05. 0.253 is not smaller than or less than 0.05. So in essence, that's all I'm doing for step four, is I'm comparing these numbers and figuring out whether something is below the 5% or above the 5%. We do need to come back to that issue of whether I'm doing a one-tailed or two-tailed test as part of this process. And if I was to make you look up the critical values rather than just use SPSS, we'd actually need to go back to Appendix B, Table B1, and we need to figure out what the value is that represents where we draw the line for that 5%, okay? This is a little more confusing, but it's just the flip side of doing our Z-score calculations. Before, what I would have you do is look up the Z-score and find the area between the mean and that Z-score. But now we're going to use the area between the mean and the Z-score to figure out what our critical Z-score value must be. So we're looking at the column for area between mean and Z-score. And if I need there to only be 5% left between, you know, that Z-score and the rest of the tail, the area between the mean and that Z-score is going to be 45. Remember, we're going to be looking at the area between the mean and the Z-score, right? And we're going to then tie that back to a specific Z-score. And we're only looking at half of the curve. So 50 minus 45 is what gives us 5. If I'm looking for 45 in that column between area between the mean and the Z-score, well, there's a 44.95 at 1.64 and a 45.05 at a Z-score of 1.65. So right between them is where I'm going to get exactly 45, 1.645. That is my critical value. If I'm looking at a directional null hypothesis where it says that the value in my test must be greater than that number, okay? That's my critical value, 1.645. If you have to do this manually and you're doing something like a Z-score, you have to start with the area between the mean and the Z-score, and then you have to work backwards, again, to figure out what Z-score would be your critical value. The area between the mean and the Z-score is kind of like the p-value. That's what we're figuring out there. But the critical value is the Z-score that goes along with it. So thinking about this, what Z-score would I need to match a 2.5%? And that would be if I took that 5% and I split it into two. Well, I would start by thinking about what's 50 minus 2.5. That should give me 47.5. So I look in my chart down the column of the area between the mean and the Z-score to where I find 47.5. And then I'm going to look to the left for my Z-score, which is my critical value for that significance level. And that critical value is 1.96. I want you to think about this process as kind of the steps we take if we had to look up the critical value. And I am not generally going to ask you to do that, but we are going to practice it in case we didn't have something like a statistical program to make this super easy for us. So practice that. Look up a Z-score for what the critical value Z-score is if you have a 1% chance, right? What is that going to be? What if my p-value is 0.1 or 10%? Where am I going to be looking to draw the line for that specific area between the mean and the z-score? And remember, I'm taking that number and I'm subtracting it from 50 to find my area between the mean and that z-score, and then I'm looking up the z-score that goes with that. Do some practice with this, and if you don't feel comfortable, let me know, but we will continue to do this again in the future as we get more and more familiar with this process. All right, we've reached our final step, which is we're going to do that comparison between that test statistic and our critical value, or more likely the p-value we get from our SPSS results and our significance level. And if the test statistic is more extreme than the critical value, it's greater than the positive number or it's less than the negative number, we are going to reject that null hypothesis. If it's not more extreme, then we have to accept the null hypothesis, saying it's possible this is due to chance, right? We're going to accept that that's the case. It's not what we want. It's kind of like a wah-wah feeling to it, but that's the right way to decide here. If we are looking at the p-value and our significance, if the p-value is less than that significance level that we set for ourselves, we are going to reject the null hypothesis. So on slide 41, I've added in some of the critical values that we would use like in standard Z-scores. So for that 99% confidence, if I had that as a two-tailed test, I'd have to have below a negative 2.576 or above a 2.576 to reject my null hypothesis. If my critical values were more about 95%, where the 2.5% is in each tail, you can see it's that negative 1.96 or positive 1.96. Really, the important thing is if I want to reject the null hypothesis, my critical values have to be more extreme than those numbers based on what I've set as my significance. They label it here confidence, 99% confidence, 95% confidence. Well, that's really just our significance value subtracted from 100, right? 95 from 100 is 5%, so there's 2.5% in each tail. All right, we are at almost 45 minutes into this conversation. It's a long one, but it is a really important one. So please take your time with this, and I want to do some kind of high-level summaries at this point. We're using significance testing and hypothesis testing in general to determine whether we reject that null hypothesis. We're just saying when we reject it that the results aren't due to chance. There's something else going on here. We're not 100% sure that it's our independent variable, maybe, that's affecting the dependent variable, but we always probably believe that, okay? Point number two, we're going to use specific tests to do our testing. And we're comparing test statistics and critical values or SPSS p-values and our significance levels to make that decision. That's that later stage of the testing process. But of course, errors can still happen. We're never certain of our results. And just because something is significant does not make it meaningful. Okay? I think now is a good time to wrap up this conversation. I am going to post a separate podcast episode related to instructions for the initial draft of the paper. Since we're already at, like I said, almost 45 minutes, I'd like to reserve that conversation separately. But what I would recommend for you in relation to this material, read the chapter again. It's one of the few that I constantly make that recommendation. It's the same thing I say for the probability chapter. If either one is difficult for you, chapter 8 or chapter 9, go back, reread, and let me know what questions you have. And then move on to chapter 10. It's not very long. It's our first set of tests. And as always, email me with any questions or concerns, and I'll get back to you as soon as I can. Thanks, everybody, and have a great rest of your day, week, weekend, wherever you're at, and I'll talk to you again soon.